We're going to be talking today about we're going to be talking today about the mechanisms that we hypothesize evolved in the human brain, which operate on how we perceive social groups, members of social groups, and how we process about them. And this is related to the talk we gave 5 years ago, in which we were exploring dyadic two-party exchanges and the claim, the hypothesis that there is a specialized subcircuit, specialized program in the brain with its own proprietary logic, which is designed for dealing with two-person cooperation. And of course, social groups, one aspect of social groups, people form coalitions, are there, it's n-person cooperation. Okay, and the kinds of specialized computation which you need to go on to succeed in cooperating in a coordinated way with other people is a very, you know, the claim is that that also requires specializations. It's a different but related set of specializations, and that's what we're going to be talking about today. And this maps onto in some aspects of questions of how people think when they and perceive and remember when they notice other people's race, that's one kind of aspect of human groups that this topic impinges upon. When Tony called more recently, he's been a little bit concerned that he got increasingly concerned that the soft psychology part might not in fact be directly related to physics, so we've tried to introduce a little bit of physics thinking into what we're doing. In particular, actually recently I started out a lot of my lectures to psychologists with a quote from Schrodinger, that what we're engaged in evolutionary psychology is an enterprise to make a natural science of the psychological, behavioral, and social sciences, to that is, to make all the different kind of strands of scientific knowledge mutually consistent. And in fact, when you do that, there's some very powerful things that come to mind, or that very powerful inferences that you can make, starting with something so basic as this, that Schrodinger in What is Life, which had a very important book, a very important impact on the discovery of DNA, how people thought about early molecular biology. The kind of issue that we'll be addressing here, and what he wrote about, was that, in fact, in our folk thinking, in our normal daily lives, the way we are designed to think, we import vitalistic notions into all sorts of areas, including psychology. Okay, and so the idea is to get away from vitalistic thinking, to take all sorts of, you know, magical anti-entropic processes that we impute and get rid of those, and see if we can come up with real mechanistic computational processes instead, which are explicit, that you can have an explicit model of, that you can run on a computer, that you can understand the physical basis of. Okay, so here he's talking about, you know, this basic, fundamental, striking feature about that distinguishes living things from non-living things. And, you know, how can the events in space and time, which take place within the spatial boundary of living organism, be accounted for by physics and chemistry? And so people of scientific orientation make this basic assumption that, of course, they do, okay? But then the question is how, okay? And if you look at living things, you know, it's by avoiding the rapid decay into the inert state of equilibrium that an organism appears so enigmatic, so much so that from the earliest times of human thought, some special non-physical or supernatural force, you know, was claimed to be operative in the organism, and in some quarters is still claimed, okay? A lot of modern psychology, in fact, implicitly has in it, you know, spirits. They don't think of them that way. They might call them a mechanism, but the mechanism does magical things, okay? So the idea is to get rid of the magical things in these computational systems. And if you look around the natural world, of course, you find that, you know, there's a striking difference between living and non-living things, impact craters, solar flares, you know, volcanic plumes, or, you know, versus, you know, spiders and redwoods and manta rays and human beings. Okay, there's this high level of order in living things which is absent from non-living things. And this high level is a particular kind of order. It's what you can call functional order. And then if you start, you think about the sort of origins of life, sorry, people here won't be able to see that. But you think of, you know, the initial replicating organism on Earth as being not very well organized, and that there's been this proliferation, and along some lineages, order has accumulated quite substantially. Of course, you can lose some order. So parasites frequently lose order, so they're a free living organism. They go into another thing. They start a separate evolutionary trajectory. They often lose a lot of complexity and so on. But basically, the thing which really differentiates living things from non-living things is the accumulation of functional order. How is that possible? Okay. And Darwin was the first person to come up with a proposal that could potentially satisfy a physicist about how you get the emergence of this really incredibly functionally intricate order in living things, okay, by non-supernatural processes. And the basic distinction from modern biological perspective is that living things are replicators with the potential for mutation, heritable mutation. So crystals may replicate, but they're not very interesting because you don't get evolution over time. But you get the initial replicating organism on Earth, the initial replicating physical system, which is by definition an organism, and natural selection, which is positive and negative feedback on design features which either increase the ability of the organism or increase the tendency of the organism to replicate successfully in a given set of environmental background conditions. You know, if it increases it, then you have positive feedback. If it decreases it, you have negative feedback. That design disappears. Okay, so you can have the accumulation of complex organization in a way that gets rid of supernatural entities. Okay, function here, therefore, you get a meaning for function, and function is something that is the the method whereby some piece of inherited organization contributes to the replication of itself or its genetic basis. And given a background environmental structure. Okay. So the next entropy in action. Okay. Basically, all functional organization in non-domestic organisms is the function of natural selection. All functional organization greater than can be explained by chance, which is almost all functional organization, is the product of natural selection. And hence, if we're going to explain interesting design, interesting architecture in living things, you explain it by reference to natural selection. That's a fairly strong and direct inference. And which brings us to this must be it. Okay, we're having a lot of entropy problems here. Okay. With the fan. Okay. Okay. So then next, when you're talking about behavior or a specific subset of adaptations or functional aspects of animals, is that subsystem which is designed to regulate behavior. Does it computationally? So then the program collapses down to mapping the computational architecture and its functional properties from perspective of natural selection. You can do so. Computational architecture is not a different hypothesis from looking at the physical structure. There are complementary ways of looking at the same system. You can do computational analyses of your computer, and then you can also look at the physical basis of how the computational structure is realized in the physical computer. Same is true for the brain. Okay, so we're looking at human nature, by which we mean the evolved computational architecture of the human brain. And we're relating it to, we want to reverse engineer the different programs in human nature, in our computational architecture. We have, of course, humans right in front of us, so the thing is, can we run experiments? Can we do various kinds of studies which will allow us to get the circuit logic that's present in different subsystems of the brain? For those of you who heard us here 5 years ago, the kind of idea is that one way you can think about what we do is, since we want to know the logic that's built into these programs, is you send in an experiment you can think of as sending in logic probes, and then you see what the map of the input structure and the map of the output structure. You give people logic problems, you give people problems to reason about, and you can see the principles that they use when they reason. That's how we were studying the logic of social exchange dyadically. Okay. Now we're looking at in-person cooperation or issues arising around in-person cooperation. So we're coming down in. Okay, so one way humans represent the social world around them is in terms of groups. This is basic set theory. Ancestrally, however, relative access to resources was partly determined by relative power. A single individual doesn't have the same kind of power that two or more individuals might have. That means that in contexts of social conflict and also some aspects of contexts of outside of social conflict, groups are relevant. How does one individual get coordinated with another individual in order to determine an outcome? Okay. And relative power, in part depends upon cooperating, coordinating with some other humans to compete effectively against other humans, ancestrally, who got what resources. So the hypothesis is that maybe some programs in our brain evolved specifically for the function of reasoning about, perceiving, categorizing in the context of social groups which are going to be coordinated with each other, often, not exclusively, but often in the context of antagonistic interactions with other social groups. From a formal sense, you can look at any even small group of people, and the total number of ways you can divide that group up into different sets is extremely large, the combinatorics. In any normal social environment, people only really spontaneously categorize in a much more restricted way. Okay, and so the question is, what are the principles which govern what social groups people see as real? What social groups do we hallucinate as being out there? And what groups, that social groups are not necessarily an objective property of the world. They are things that are parameters in programs in our heads. And if we all agree on certain social groups as real, what that means is we all have the same parameter settings in our head about how to divide up, a large set of people into a very small number of groups, generally small number of groups. Okay. We're asking the question, what's the logic of the programs in our head which accomplish this kind of problem? And so, in a given environment, what causes our evolved programs to settle on some groupings rather than others? So what's the circuit logic in our neurocomputational programs that cause us to see social groups? What? I know, I'm just about to, one more overhead, or one and a half more overheads. Okay. With respect to race, okay, a kind of normal theory of race is that race is really out there. Okay, and we see what's really out there, that there's green apples, there's red apples, they're really out there. That's why we see that there are green and red apples. Okay, well, with modern genetics, we can go in and we can see, that's another kind of objective measure, that if there were, hereditary separate human groups, you ought to be able to see that at the genetic level. And geneticists go in and it doesn't divide up the world in the way that we spontaneously do on a social basis. Okay, so there's a number of different ways that Lita's going to talk about the perceptual byproduct hypothesis, which is the notion that we socially group people based on, our perceptual systems are designed to see color. People vary in color, for example, and therefore we divide people up like red apples and green apples. That theory can be, we can falsify that theory genetically. You know, here you have Swedes, you know, at the low end of allele, Icelanders at the high end, and so on, that it doesn't group almost,
what
yeah.
What you're supposed to take from this table?
What you're supposed to take from this table is that what we would normally, the theory that we would divide people into different human groups based on their genetics, okay, that's an easy, simple problem which maps onto the racial categories which people in daily life apply. Okay, and the genetics doesn't support the folk theory of race.
Okay.
Right. Could we explain specifically how this shows it?
Okay. So Japanese and Icelanders are very similar.
That's not the point. The point is nobody knows whatever genes code for things like skin color and so on must be protein coding genes as opposed to non-coding genes. Nobody knows exactly what those are, but you can look at other protein-coding genes and see if they segregate by racial group.
Right. That.
And what this is so 55, arbitrarily groups of in what population where more than 60% of people have an allele, or where 40 to 44% of people have an allele, or whatever.
You could imagine a world in which Northern Europeans all have a certain gene which Africans lack, and Africans all have a gene with Northern Europeans don't have. That's
average,
not the world. This is the
average occurrence among those populations.
Yes, of the old allele.
Right.
Just to pick it.
There could be variances which differ a lot.
Okay, the whole point is to show that it doesn't work.
I know, but I want to know what precisely doesn't work.
Okay, right. And we just picked the old allele. You could pick, you know, there's 30,000 different genes that you could, that code for proteins.
And none of the genes, this structure would work for
No single, there isn't a gene which is present in one race which is lacking in it, that all or most normal members of one race have, which other races lack. Okay, so what you have is slight differences in proportions of certain genes, and when you look at, when you do any kind of transect, it doesn't map onto, there's no objective way of going from the genetic existing known protein transcribed genes to our folk theory of race. Right. Exactly. Yeah. No. There's always gene flow. It's just a matter of, would there be something that would mark and show up in the face of an individual because the genes is being transcribed, which would sort people according to our folk categories? There. In fact, you could find things which aren't transcribed.
That gene does not correlate to that one.
That particular one doesn't. It just happened to be one that came to hand. But
it is a common protein coding gene. Ones that code for nothing are, you would start from a mutation somewhere and spread till it reaches geographic boundary. And so genes that code for nothing.
People have been searching like crazy for genes which express themselves in appearance, which would predict and account for race. They don't find them. They can't find them. And you instead find that I just picked that because it was perfectly typical, not because it was unusual. And I wouldn't want to make the case by wasting your time and going through 30,000 different. Not that they have actually all the 30,000, but. Right. You can find a few proteins which are found only in certain races, but they're found only in very small minorities in those people's there. These are sort of so-called private mutations.
I have a question. This is very interesting because maybe one gene doesn't work, but you know, what makes a Swede in some sense? If you have a basis of genes, I mean, not one, but you know, four or five genes,
Could you do some clustering in, you know, an n-dimensional space?
Right, but there must be something that makes a Swede a Swede. And I think it's going to be similar to what makes an Icelander an Icelandic also, because there's a lot of migration back and forth from those two societies.
Right, the claim is, well, I certainly wouldn't deny that there are some phenotypically perceivable cues which have genetic bases. They have been extraordinarily hard to find, and they don't tend to map onto the social groups that people perceive so clearly, okay, and so yes, you could say in the genes that have not yet been mapped, perhaps we can find some that will do this work for us. Okay, but it's not as if people have been doing pretty, you know, I mean, what genes get picked are, you know, it's not like there's been some category which in principle would be excluded.
Also, and, more to the point, and, for anything that people have been able to look at, the within population variance is huge compared to
between population variance. Right.
And there are strong theoretical reasons that have to do with the way natural selection works, why that would be true. It tends to favor, for reasons having to do with resistance against pathogens, it tends to recruit rare alleles into a population.
But
this is up to see if
right, early work could that maybe worth a minute, which is just that.
Yeah.
A minute, okay. Why are organisms sexually reproducers? Okay, big mystery, because you have random recombination, causes all sorts of engineering problems. Okay. And that goes along with the big discovery that there was all this protein variation, which nobody expected to find. In general, in natural selection, if one gene is better than another, in evolutionary time, it should pretty rapidly become fixed at 100%, okay? And yet you find a whole, when you look at adaptations, Gray's Anatomy, everybody has the same thing. You look at, you open your any page of Gray's Anatomy at random, put your finger down on the most minor thing, okay? And it's true for people all over the world. So in adaptations, we have a universal human design, okay? Then you go in, and so you expect to find that at the genetic level. You go in the genetic level, and you find an explosion of genetic diversity. And the question is, what is all that genetic diversity doing there? And it might be related to the question of what sexual reproduction does. Is it maximizes genetic diversity among offspring, or it increases genetic diversity among offspring, as opposed to asexual reproduction? And in long-lived organisms, which tend to be sexual, one claim you could have is that what genetic diversity is doing is that your adaptations want uniformity, but parasites feed off of uniformity. As soon as they adapt to one host design, then they can explosively exploit all others with the same genetic design. So asexual reproduction, which among long-lived individuals, short-lived parasites can rapidly evolve around any fixed defense. Okay, so the notion of genetic diversity is there because it retards contagion by making the aspects of the phenotype which parasites care about, which is low-level biochemistry, different, while the high-level structure is coming out uniformly. That's one kind of claim. But what you find is that this genetic diversity is more evenly distributed than would be accounted for by chance. Okay, so that if you take things like O alleles or anything like that, you find that almost all human groups have these significant variants in sizable proportions. Okay, so you could easily imagine a world in which all Japanese are all blood type A, and all Teratophagans are all blood type B, and all Danish people are blood type O. Okay, that's not the world we live in. We all live with all populations have more or less intermediate proportions of these different genes. Okay, so it's very hard to construct out of that basic population genetics reality. You could, as somebody was suggesting, if you have high end dimensionality, you can imagine seeing the world in terms of lots of these dimensions, okay? But that's also socially not how people see the world. Socially, people believe that there's a pure X and there's a pure Y, and okay, maybe some of them marry, so there's some hybrids, but there's a very strong folk theory of race, okay? And people, when I teach my students, I show them the genetics and they just sort of say, oh, this is some sort of, you know, politically correct crap that I'm being taught. You know, I have eyes. I can see that there are really different races. Okay, so the question is there something interesting in our mental programs which is causing us to impose order in excess of what's really out there, okay, in the genetic perception? And just let me finish. Okay, so okay, so there's a mystery of race categorization and race perception, and why do we hallucinate race more strongly and more categorically than perception would warrant?
I mean, it seems to me that genetics is irrelevant. The point is, let's say skin color. A computer could distinguish the reflectivity coefficient of different people's skin and categorize them that way, and I think that would correlate very well to our perception. And that, the reflectivity coefficient of your skin is just as real as your genetics.
Okay, there's two reasons. One reason I use the word hallucinate is because all of our representations that we experience are, as Roger Shepherd, who's a perceptual psychologist, says, they're externally driven hallucinations. Okay, we don't see reality; we see a a simplified and extracted and processed reality working, I mean, processed version of reality operating inside our computational system. And then the question is, you know, yes, you could make that claim. You could sort of say that that's the first, the perceptual byproduct hypothesis is the initial opening hypothesis that seems most reasonable, most plausible. Why would you go further? Okay. The genetics was one attempt to get around that, but why don't we just do the experimental data?
The reality was that what you perceive, right? I mean, you're going to make a distinction between some underlying reality.
Well, the reason why one goes to genes is because genes are what particular dimensions can you, after the fact, given that you've made a categorization, come up with some emphasis on some perceptual properties which would justify it. And since people can consensually sort that, yes, you can come up with a way of doing that. The question is, sort of from an objective point of view, why does it happen one way versus another? Is it just is it just emerging out of the properties of our perceptual system?
And also, if you just took a single dimension, as one you were mentioning, it would put Tamil Indians together with sub-Saharan Africans and so forth, which is not the way
there's more than one visual cue, and I would bet I could come up with six of them.
You could have passed the test.
Oh, yes. Yes, of course.
That's part of what we're talking about. But what
do you mean by that?
Yeah.
Oh.
I've got to get you on.
Okay. Okay. So how have psychologists been looking at the way that we're doing a little jump here, because John was just trying to motivate the idea of why it's might be, you might think it's odd. He was trying to explain why it might be odd that we perceive race. But let me take it from a different tack at the moment. How have psychologists, and this was this the methods I'm going to be talking about were pioneered in social psychology by Shelley Taylor and Fisk. They wanted to know, in the course of person perception, when you encounter an individual, are there certain dimensions, certain categories about that individual that you encode automatically, spontaneously? And they developed this paradigm that's an unobtrusive measure of the extent to which somebody's encoding a characteristic of another person. It's called the memory confusion paradigm. And what happens is you first see a series, you're told that you're going to see an interaction amongst various people. And you see a photo comes up and then the sentence that person purportedly said, okay? And then you see another photo and the sentence that person said. And then you see another photo and the sentence that person said. And you're just told, form impressions of these people as you see them, okay? Then there's a little distractor task, and then there's a surprise recall task. And so at the recall task stage, it's the question is who said what? So a sentence will come up on the screen with all of the photos. Okay, and you're supposed to say which person said that sentence. Right. Now, we're not concerned with when somebody gets it right, because if somebody gets it right, then you don't know anything about how they encoded that person. We're interested in the errors that they've got, and Tony wanted an equation somewhere in the talk.
I want an equation.
Here's an equation.
Right. Facts.
Okay. there are facts that are not necessarily illuminated by equations,
okay.
but if a category is not being encoded, then the error should be random with respect to that category when you're misattributing a sentence. So let's say that a woman had said the sentence. Okay, if you hadn't noticed the sex of the person who said the sentence, the probability that you'd think another woman said the sentence when you made an error would be the same as the probability that you thought a man said the sentence if you had not encoded the sex of the speaker. Okay, if the category is being encoded, then your errors will not be random with respect to that category. So if a woman said the sentence, you'll be more likely to make an error in which you think another woman said the sentence than where you thought made a mistake and thought a man would say the sentence. So the probability of within category errors will be greater than the probability of between category errors. And concretely, what you do is for each subject, n is the number of subjects, for each subject, you count the different kinds of errors they make, you correct for the different base rate probabilities of the errors. And then you do a test. You for each subject, you've got a different score, the within category errors minus the between category errors. And you see, does that differ from zero? Is that greater than zero? Okay, equation, you happy?
Good.
Yeah. Okay, you do a little statistical test on that, and from that statistical test, you can get two pieces of information. One is, are people encoding that dimension to a significant extent? You know, is it statistically significant? But more importantly, you can get an effect size. How strongly are they encoding that dimension? And the effect sizes we're using here are R. They're like regular correlation coefficient, but they're derived from the t-test here. And it'll tell you whether the R can go from 0 to 1, and it'll tell you whether the effect is small or big. Okay? Now,
just when...
Yep.
Really clear, if, for example...
That was really clear.
I know it's very clear at one level, but at an intuitive level.
Yeah.
Okay. If you know... If you confuse something that...
These are physicists. They find my equation much more intuitive.
If you confuse something that Bill Cosby said with George Carlin, okay, then you might think the principle of which you're quoting, Bill, that you might think the median would be an important dimension, the person's dimension that you're representing people on. Okay? If, on the other hand, you confuse something Bill Cosby said with O.J. Simpson, then you might think that race was the more important underlying category. This is an unobtrusive measure. People probably couldn't control it, even if they were aware of what's going on.
And the subjects don't,
So you're getting beyond the political desirability, I don't want to appear to be a racist. You're getting what are the underlying person dimensions that people are representing people in terms of.
Yeah. Now, the thing that happened when they did these experiments was they found that people were encoding three dimensions, sex, age, and race. And as I'll explain, there were reasons why we thought race was odd and that sex and age were not. But I'll get to that in a minute. There were many, many attempts to experiment.
Those were the ones that had high schools.
Those were the ones where, yes.
And you had some perhaps that had lower schools.
Yes. These are the ones that stood out as you get people automatically encoding it. And then what people tried to do is they tried to find context that would decrease the extent to which you encoded it, and they failed. I'm going to tell you one that succeeds for race. But there were a lot of attempts to get rid of race encoding in particular.
There's been 20 years of it.
It's been going on for 20 years.
To try and get rid of.
Are you encoding color or race?
Race.
So you would distinguish between a West Indian and a Black American?
These weren't done on, these were done just with, these were done in America and in England and with black and white targets.
So that's
targets.
Color, right? That's
well, then there's other kinds of, you know, there's hair and... facial configurations as, you know,
people
it was actual
as black
it's photo.
Often have lighter skin color than other people categorized as white.
Sometimes,
sometimes.
Mariah Carey.
They're overlapping distributions.
But
the question is, what were the pictures that were actually used? Did
photos.
They actually have light skinned blacks in them and dark skinned whites or not?
No, but that wasn't one of the points of the experiment.
But it doesn't matter whether that was the point of
the I will.
It matters what the experiment actually was.
Yes. They have done it many ways. Some used.
What was the experiment?
The other people's experiments?
No. What is the experiment?
Oh, I can show you I can show you a couple of our stimuli, and I will show you a couple of our stimuli. But let me tell you. It would be better. It would be better if you let me continue. Okay. So here are some of the things that people did to try to get rid of race encoding. They tried having the targets discussing race relations versus a race-neutral topic, because they thought, well, maybe if you're discussing a race-neutral topic, you won't encode race as much. Had no effect. People encoded it just as much. They looked at whether the subject who's doing the encoding is black or white. That had no effect. But both whether you're black or white, you'd encoded race of the targets. They led subjects to believe that they would be interacting with these targets, because that's a context that's... in other experiments has showed promotes an encoding of individuating information over category-based information. That had no effect. Having the subject operate under cognitive load, giving them other tasks to do at the same time, had no effect. Warning them that there'll be a recall test, no effect. A competing dimension was included, so you have the targets that differ on both sex and race. That did not decrease race encoding. You can keep that in mind, because that's interesting. And then they got a little desperate, and so in this experiment where they had targets, so half the targets would be male, half would be female. Of the males, half would be black, half would be white. Of the females, half would be black, half would be white, right? And then they tried even drawing attention to race or away from race. So in one experiment they say, pay particular attention to people's race because we found that that predicts the kinds of opinions that they have, et cetera, et cetera. And in the alternate condition they said, pay a particular attention to the person's sex because we found that that predicts their opinions about things, et cetera, et cetera. No effect. People were still encoding race at very high levels. And that's what led people to think that this race encoding was mandatory, because why is it that, you know, none of these manipulations are making any difference to the race encoding?
So wouldn't it make sense to take, say, for instance, if you just take all of the same color, say blacks, and then put South Indians there, and then put African Americans there, put Aborigines there from Australia, and then people are going along to, these are very, three groups because they're completely different races.
Yes.
But they're the same color, so you match the color dimension, and now you see whether they are picking across races or
that would be an interesting.
This is not the same experiment.
I don't know what effect you think I'm claiming, but why don't I
go through the conceptual
No, I don't think that's the interesting claim.
We have to dephase that first.
Yes. Okay. Right. Okay. The perceptual byproduct hypothesis is basically the notion that race is merely encoded as a byproduct of color vision, for example. You know, that no matter what object it would be, whether it's a tomato or a person, that you notice its color. And the perceptual byproduct hypothesis would hold that that has to be automatic and mandatory. You know, that you notice the color of things in an automatic and mandatory fashion, and because you notice the color of things in an automatic and mandatory fashion, you'll notice the color of people. Of course, race is a more complicated notion than just color. But anyway, this is one hypothesis, and it has certain predictions that follow from it. One is that if you can't help, if you have a domain general categorization process that cannot help but use color in encoding things, whether they're people or non-social objects, then subjects would encode color in an automatic and mandatory manner whenever there are obvious differences in the stimuli, even when those have no social significance. For example, they don't indicate race, team membership, personality, status, politics, or any other social dimension. So there was a great experiment that was done where people had all women targets. Half of them were black and half of them were white. They were dressed in sweatshirts. Half the sweatshirts were black, half the sweatshirts were white. But sweatshirt color was not correlated with race. So you've got black targets, half of which are wearing white sweatshirts and half black sweatshirts, and white targets, half of which are wearing black sweatshirts, half wearing white sweatshirts. Race was encoded strongly. Sweatshirt color was encoded zero, just not at all. It was not a dimension of categorization. Another prediction of the perceptual byproduct hypothesis is that task demands that decrease or increase the extent to which subjects encode perceptual dimensions in tasks with non-social stimuli should increase or decrease the extent to which subjects encode race. That does not happen at all. So for example, that's what was happening to your slides. So for example, encoding color and shape, when you're talking about non-social stimuli like squares that are big or small and green or blue, et cetera, if you say to a person, pay particular attention to color or pay particular attention to size, to perceptual dimension with non-social stimuli, that does change the encoding of that perceptual dimension. But instructions to attend to race versus sex had no effect on race encoding. Okay? So it wasn't being budged by something that does affect encoding of other things. Yes?
This still doesn't show that anything but perceptual coding of skin color is important, as opposed to perceptual coding of other colors, other things' color.
So a third hypothesis then would be, that follows from this, is that perceptual similarity should affect how strongly race is encoded. So there should be prototype effects, because you've got lots of different characteristics that are co-varying with race, right? And so what people did was they did these experiments, but they had, so you do see that with artificial categories, with non-social categories. So if you just use objects, you will see prototype effects. So if you have a lot of things that share a lot of characteristics, they'll be categorized better and more richly than sets that share fewer characteristics. But when you do this in this paradigm, Stanger and his colleagues had, in one experiment, they had the faces of a given race either very dissimilar from one another, so not a prototypical black face or prototypical white face, but a lot of variation in the faces. And in another experiment, they had very prototypical faces that didn't vary as much from a prototype. Made no difference. People encoded it just as strongly in each case. So these are three. Now, there are obviously some of the experiments that you've suggested are very nice experiments.
Right? I think they're just coding by color. I mean,
No. It's not. No. There are wide in one condition, there's wide variations in color among, say, the black targets. And in the other, there's very few very little variation in color.
That was the question that was asked before, whether they used people who looked not whose color, skin color was not very black, and some were very black. And you had answered no, I think. So in fact, this
one, yes. So
example, saying that had no.
That's right.
What you had asked.
Right. So there's little evidence here that this is just a byproduct of some domain general. By domain general, I mean that goes across categories. It doesn't depend on whether it's a person or not a person, etc. That this is a domain general property of color vision or color categorization for objects, whether they're social or not. Now, we were interested in another hypothesis. From an evolutionary point of view, the fact that people automatically encode the sex of a person and their age makes a lot of sense, because in hunter-gatherer societies, your sex and your age support a lot of inferences about a person. So you can make a lot of predictions about a person if you know that they're a two-year-old boy, or if you know they're a teenage girl, for example. Or if you know they're a teenage girl versus a teenage boy, you'll make different predictions about them.
I'm not sure it was said, but that
people automatically...
The basic result of all these kinds of studies is that
people encode.
There are three dimensions that people automatically encode. One is gender, sex, another is
age
or life stage, and the third is the race.
Okay? Right.
And so...
Right, exactly.
What's the fourth that might have been there?
Well, I'm sorry, what?
What's the fourth categorization that might have been there but didn't show up? I'm not really thinking. Because all my friends have two eyes, one nose, one mouth.
That's skinny.
There's been status. People will encode some status. They'll encode status cues. So if you dress up targets in either high status outfits or low status outfits, they'll encode status as a dimension.
They don't
encode shirt color unless that's, you know,
profession.
When it means nothing.
Profession is not automatically encoded.
I'm trying to think about this particular method and this particular paradigm.
But the question is, what could you? They actually said, what others could there be? Why is it striking that you have those three? Because that's the only three there are.
Okay? That's not the only thing there are. There are a million things that could be true, but they haven't tested a million things.
Characteristics of a human as opposed to, my friends change their clothes sometimes, thinking of physical characteristics of a human. Because the three things you just listed are physical characteristics that are either permanent or changed or predictable.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, most people, it's not
yes,
that this...
Yes, and we actually think that's why they're, we don't think that's not why they're encoded. We think that... two of those three are exactly why they're important, is because they're informative dimensions which tell a lot about, which support a lot of inferences, and therefore would be worth encoding as opposed to other things. But the issue is, if you have, the counter hypothesis is the mind's a general purpose computer. Okay, so you hook up a visual camera.
There's different counter hypotheses. I'd rather just go on in my own way, if that's okay. Okay?
Okay.
Question, did you have the meter rule next to all the people so they could assess their relative size?
No, size was never, I've never seen an experiment in which size per se was manipulated.
The question needs to be broken down into things that could have been encoded in those experiments.
That's right.
And things that could have been encoded.
That's what I was trying to think about. I was trying to think about what kinds of things had people looked at. I don't have an encyclopedic memory at the moment for every single thing that's ever been tested. The things that have come up reliably over and over again as automatically encoded are these three dimensions. But other ones that people have gotten effects were for like social status, manner of dress that indicates social status, that will be encoded. I haven't tried a million different dimensions. It's not the simplest kind of takes.
Sort of
well. Yeah, but these it's almost always a head and shoulder shot in these experiments.
Other experiments.
There haven't been ones that looked at height. No. There's a lot of different things that you could encode that haven't been particularly looked at.
Hair color?
Nobody has systematically done hair color. The hair color of the people varies in these experiments, but nobody has done the analysis for hair color per se. I actually want one of my students to do that. because that would be interesting, because that's a dimension that basically doesn't have any social relevance, but it's a perceptual dimension.
Or like until yeah. maybe 10 years.
Right? Yeah. Well, yeah.
So
yeah.
Did you try accent?
Oh, we would love to try accent. Well, let me tell you, well, as you'll see, there's a reason why. Why don't I tell you what we did do? Yes, yes. Okay. So sex and age made sense to us. They would have supported inferences evolutionarily. So, but race was a very weird one, because if you think about it, quite apart from everything John was saying about the genetics of race and so forth, you can even forget about all that. For hunter-gatherer, you move by foot. You're a nomadic person moving by foot. You don't, the typical residential move of a hunter-gatherer is on average maybe 40 miles. You're just not going to be seeing people from geographically distant enough parts of the world that they would count as, in some sense, a different race. So you're not going to, so natural selection cannot create a neural computational mechanism designed to encode a dimension of the world that hunter-gatherers wouldn't have been exposed to. Here in the modern world, where there's all kinds of fast transportation, we are exposed to people from different parts of the globe who look different from one another, right? That's not part of the world in which we evolved. And so it was, to us, it was very strange, this finding, because it didn't make sense from an evolutionary point of view that you'd have a mechanism that was specifically designed to encode race. Yeah? Know what? Yes, we do. There's a lot of studies about hunter-gatherers. Well, it depends on if you're talking about, like, you know, Neanderthals and Homo sapiens sapiens being in the same place. There's lots of debates about that.
The basic answer is the limited mobility of hunter-gatherers and the fact that people, a racial difference is people meaning that people thrive in genetic difference. And so there's always, you always marry people who are nearby, almost by definition. People hunter-gatherers walk from one place to another, so that the kinds of, it's always so that the hunter-gatherer world compared to the modern world would have been much more smoothly graded than the
So the recent findings, or relatively recent findings, that in the Neanderthals and Homo sapiens, for example, did coexist in some regions that are not allowed?
It's not to say what you're doing with in terms of human design is you're weighting the average over all areas, over all time. So, question is, if there was some limited period of a hybrid zone or something like that, would that have been powerful enough to build a human universal to cause the drive of the genetic fixation of a mechanism over the whole distribution of the entire species? That's not the way natural selection would work. It has to work because the selection pressure is a general selection pressure that endures long enough over a large enough area. And so this is a pretty solid inference. It would be extremely hard to see how this could not be true.
Well, one thing that actually would have varied, would have been an important social dimension, I think I should just, since I have 6 minutes for the whole experiment, I think I should drive on here. That would have been an important dimension is coalitional alliances. There's between group conflicts, and even within groups, there's changing patterns of cooperation and competition along as different issues arise. And so it would be important to have computational machinery that can automatically keep track of the who's allied with whom in your social environment. Now, a mechanism that was well designed for doing this would, you would expect, would notice patterns of cooperation and competition. And then, because behaviors that are revelatory of your alliances are not happening all the time, I mean, I don't know what kinds of intrigues are at the ITP and who Tony might be allied with over one intrigue and not another and so forth. He's emitting no revelatory behaviors at the moment, for example. But because people don't, you can't tell from their behavior all the time who's they're allied with, you would expect that the system would be designed to boost in saliency any more constantly present cue, perceptual cue, that was correlated with patterns of alliance, like accent would be an excellent example of that. And so if you think about it in the modern world, we certainly don't live in a racially integrated society. There are patterns of cooperation and competition that are correlated with race. And so alliance tracking machinery would note these patterns of cooperation and competition and boost in saliency a perceptual cue, you know, race that is correlated with that. And So the idea is that if you wouldn't have mechanisms designed specifically for encoding race, then the fact that we encode race must be a byproduct of something. It doesn't appear to be a byproduct of just general purpose color vision. What else might be a byproduct of? We're suggesting it's a byproduct of coalition encoding machinery. And so that you're, in a sense, you're mapping race onto coalition, to a cognitive primitive of coalition.
You're taking all these combinatorial possibilities, all these dimensions, you could be using this framework, of which there's a very large number, and you are collapsing them, that your perceptual system is being tuned by what predicts coalitional affiliation.
So this predicts a number of things. One is, it predicts that people ought to encode coalition, that if you provide some sort of coalition in an experiment like this, that you should be able to get the case of people encoding coalition. It implies that you should be able to get people encoding coalition, that if you combine coalition with a perceptually available cue, like shirt color, something like that, that you should boost its saliency and give it almost race-like properties. You know, people should automatically and mandatorily encode it. Right? It implies also that, if race is not correlated with that salient coalitional conflict, that the extent to which people encode race should decrease. I don't know that in 4-minute experiment you would get it to, you know, go to nothing, but anyway, so this is what we did. We told people, these are just two examples of two of the stimuli, you'd only see one at a time. So the same experiment as before, you see a face and you see a sentence, then you see a face and you see a sentence, and you know, you're told that there's been these two basketball teams that got into this big fight last year. It got really ugly. They've come together for the first time to discuss what happened before the next season's coming, and you're going to see a conversation among them, form impressions of these people. And then the conversation that you see is very antagonistic. So the first one says something like, you know, the fight last year was all your guys' fault. You're a bunch of idiots, you know. And the guy says, what are you calling idiots, you know? And then the next guy might say,
but the point here is that race does not predict.
The first point is that there are cues of coalitional alliance that are in the content of what people are saying. So if person one is insulting person two and person three is agreeing with person one, you can infer that the one and three are in cahoots against two, right? And so the conversation had that quality so that it is possible to infer from what people are saying what team they're on, okay? Now, team is not correlated with race. So there's eight different male faces, like the ones you saw. Each team has two black and two white members. So there is no correlation between team and race in this experiment. Now, we did two different versions of the experiment, one in which there is no perceptually available cue to coalition. So everybody's identically dressed. They're all wearing gray, you know, practice jerseys, right? In the other condition, we add in a cue that's correlated with coalition in order to see if we can give coalition race-like properties, right? So
Okay. Then it becomes a pseudo race.
So the first thing, I'm going to be pseudo PowerPoint here. So what happens when you have only verbal cues to coalition alliance? You have no perceptual cues to coalition alliance. Well, yes, you do. These are, what it's plotted as effect sizes. This R, you know, so if they're, you know, you can see if they're big or small. race is encoded, and this is a very standard kind of amount of encoding that you find in the literature. Coalition is also encoded, even though there's no perceptual cue whatsoever to coalitional alliance here. There's only these verbal cues about who said what, you know. I should say that this effect, this is a moderate effect, it's being driven by the men in the sample, this particular effect. The men are sifting for who's allied with whom in these photos in a way that the women were not.
This is the people guessing.
Yes, this is the subjects, our
the
subjects.
Men are contributing to that 0.3.
Yeah, they're like around here on the coalition encoding, and the women are somewhat lower. Yeah, that's the only sex difference in the experiment. But it's an effect size. It's the square root of t squared over t squared plus the degrees of freedom. So it's derived from the t and the sample size and so forth. But it's an effect size, and you can compare it across different conditions this way.
Are you implying that women are less efficient than men in figuring the...
Not efficient, no. If you actually, nobody's ever told to figure out who's allied with whom. Uh-huh. You're told to form impressions of individual people. It's like the women are forming impressions of individual people. if I give men and women, and we've done this, if I give them on a piece of paper all of these sentences and I say sort these into who's in what coalition, the women do just as well as the men do. So if I tell them to do that, yeah. It's just that they're not sort of sifting through, you know. They kind of don't care in this case. When there's no perceptual cue and in this kind of context. Okay.
Go down if you increase the number of people in the team, because it seems like...
I couldn't fit them all on my screen if I increased the number, but that would be an interesting thing to know.
So I'm just asking, I mean, race seems, in these experiments, seems to be a binary thing, which you would decide, but figuring out coalitions, you know, who's in a coalition with women and women, many people is much more complicated.
Yes, it is a more complicated thing. I can't answer your question yet, but let me show you the rest of the experiment. So the first thing to note is, in the absence of any perceptual cue whatsoever, people can do, especially men, encode the coalition of targets. Now the next question we want to know is, by adding in a perception, and notice that that's very difficult because at recall, the race is on the face of all the targets, but nothing about the coalition is perceptually available at recall. So the next question is, when you put in the people on the different teams in different color jerseys, so you create a perceptual cue that's correlated with coalition, what happens to coalition encoding? It goes way up. That's it. Psychologists die for effect sizes this big, by the way. You don't see 0.8 effect sizes, very often in psychology. It goes way up, and that's actually higher than race was encoded in the former experiment. It's significantly higher strength of encoding.
Did race
be
the same?
Nope, I'm going to show you. Pretend it's PowerPoint, and I'm going to click, click, click. The race went down. Race encoding, there's a significant drop in the race encoding. Oh, I should say both men and women are encoding, when there's a color cue, both men and women are encoding coalition at this very high level. And you get this drop in race encoding. Now, you might be asking yourself the question, maybe you're getting the drop in race encoding simply because there's a domain general constraint on attention, such that people cannot attend to two dimensions at the same time. Now, if you remember, I told you experiments before where that was shown to not be true, that people can encode at very high levels sex and race at the very same time. But anyway, we wanted to test that hypothesis ourselves, so we did exactly the same experiment, but instead of using race, we used sex. So we have two teams, and there's two men and two women on each team. Now, sex is the kind of thing that we would think was a conceptual primitive built into our neurocomputational machinery, such as you automatically encode that across situations. Everybody's the same race in this experiment. So again, you have two dimensions. But the question we're asking is the human mind capable of encoding two dimensions at a very high level? Or is there a necessary trade-off such that that's all that indicates nothing more than that? The answer is this is that experiment, that yes, you can in fact, here's the two next to each other. This is a sex and coalition, this is a race and coalition. You can, in fact, easily encode two dimensions at very high levels. There's nothing, no property of the mind that makes it a necessary trade-off in the encoding of these two dimensions. There's a small thing, but the point is that the mind is able to encode two dimensions with an effect size of 0.8 at the same time. So there was nothing necessary about the fact that this dropped. So in spite of the fact that our minds are capable of encoding two dimensions at the same time, the race was, you dropped off in this experiment. And let me say one more thing. Interestingly, they're still encoding it somewhat here. We did another version of the experiment with just different faces and so forth. In that version, it dropped to not significant. Race encoding dropped to not significant.
What verbal only means. Why is it 0.9 and not 1 on sex?
Well, you know, you're in a seminar, somebody says something, you think, somebody,
oh, just
a recall.
Recall.
Yeah.
Recall.
So somebody says something about string theory.
Right.
You might think it was, a woman might have said it and you might have thought it was a man who said it.
Right.
Or vice versa.
A man said it, a woman said it.
Yeah. So it's a recall test.
How long is the time?
Oh, well, they're exposed to the stimuli. This conversation, it's actually a short conversation of only 24 sentences. Mm-hmm. Eight people are involved. Each person says three sentences in random. It's all in random order, etc. Mm-hmm. It takes a total of 4 minutes of exposure. They do a distractive task, like how many states start with the letter A. Just, you know.
You get distracted.
Yeah, get distracted, yeah. And then the sentences come up in random order, and you have to say which person said what. And so this effect, you have a lifetime of experience in which race is predicting things in your social environments, predicting social outcomes. In this experiment, 4 minutes of exposure to an alternative social universe in which it does not predict coalition was decreasing the extent to which people were encoding race. And in one of the experiments, it actually went to not even encoded to a significant degree, statistically significant. Yeah.
Have you tried later going back and seeing if there's a reduction in how much race is encoding? If you put them back doing a test where you don't have an alternative coalition signal?
We have not done that. I would have no reason to think that it. Our claim, actually, I would doubt that it's a permanent effect.
We've diminished racism in people from a 4 minute.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think we have a tool here for eliminating racism.
Yeah.
No. In fact, it was sort of funny because when this came out in PNAS and they had put a press alert about it, so we started getting calls about it, and I had a number of reporters who thought that that's what we were saying. I was like, no, it's not like we have a cure here for racism.
But it tells but we should follow what it does say. It says one thing. It says. The claim here is that there's evidence to support the notion that the inner representation of race is coalition marked with certain perceptual cues. Okay, but that's the essence of what race is being treated as by the mind. Okay, and that doesn't have to be true. The second kind of thing that comes out of this is that you could imagine that this coalitional stuff is fixed and permanent. You've imprinted when you're a child. You can never get rid of it. It's stable. Okay, what this seems to imply is that spontaneously. One's racial awareness is volatile, and it's going up and down depending upon whether you're in a social environment in which race does predict coalition or race does not predict coalition.
Okay, after we had done these experiments, it was this very interesting thing in the New York Times after September 11th. There was an article that said September 11th attack narrows racial divide in New York. And the claim of the article was that all of a sudden, like white police officers and black teenage boys were getting along very, very well and so forth. But at the same time,
yeah,
there were
that's
these...
That's not going to last.
but at the same time, there were hate crimes that were happening against anybody that had a Q that was associated with being Middle Eastern. So there's poor Sikh guy who was attacked and killed because he had a turban and so forth. That's exactly the kind of effect we're seeing here, where the influence of race is becoming less salient, but a different, almost immediately... an arbitrary coalition will cues like what kind of headgear you're wearing, Muslim is becoming relevant. Yeah.
In this experiment, in the previous one, if you remember correctly, it doesn't count.
That's right. The reason it doesn't count.
Good memories, there are some.
Right.
Yeah, but nobody. This is so hard. Yeah.
That's what I want to ask.
It's very hard.
Like
66%. So they're performing above chance, but.
It doesn't vary widely.
No.
It's sort of.
It's very, very hard.
So we wanted to. We sort of tuned the task so there was enough errors to analyze.
You need to. Everybody does. You need to because you can only see the thing is if somebody gets it right, they could get it right because they guessed. They could get it right because they particularly remembered the person's race and sex or whatever. They could get it right because they just remembered some. That there was a mole on that person's face who said that. You just don't know anything when the person gets it right. This is a method that depends on errors, and so you design it so that there will be errors, because that's the only way that you can see into the mind, see into what the dimensions are.
This task doesn't sound that hard, nevertheless.
Oh, it's so hard. I mean, it's amazingly hard. I have terrible difficulty doing this task. I mean, because, you know, if somebody, you know, which person said, it was you idiots that started the whole thing.
You've seen before, you see him for a few seconds.
You see each sentence with a face for 8.5 seconds, you know, and then you're supposed to remember, and you don't even know that that's what you're going to mean. Yeah.
The anthropological cultural alternative explanations. There's this whole thing about how early societies evolved to begin to see us and them as the label, your group versus the other group, by wearing shells, if you can,
yeah.
All of this looks like it could be explained by cultural imprinting of you know, the us versus them.
That's not actually an alternative hypothesis. That's very deeply what our that's very deeply.
Need to be evolutionarily explained because our culture can totally develop about real circumstances where we fight other people and we build up cultures that we
The question about what culture is, I mean, people have the notion that there is this well-validated theory out there that there is some kind of general learning mechanism and that culture inhabits this general learning mechanism, okay? So far as we know, there's no evidence for any, there's no evidence that there is a general learning system out there, as opposed to what we're trying to do is we're trying to see what are the computational elements that go...
That cause people to see the world sometimes in terms of us versus them. What we're saying is we're saying what's a computational machinery that causes people under certain circumstances to divide the world into us's and them's, and under other circumstances to not divide the world into us's and them's. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to understand the nature of the learning mechanism, if you will, that causes that to happen. So that's why it's not an alternative to a cultural theory. I mean, it's part of the whole context here that, I mean, that people do, they mark their coalition alliances all the time, sometimes explicitly by wearing, you know, like the Crips and the Bloods in terms of what colors they wear, or in terms of what, you know, political buttons and so forth. Sometimes people mark their coalition alliances incidentally without even realizing it. You know, accent is one of these things that's, you know, that follows who you grew up with. And so, you know.
The idea here is not just that there are different tribes or big groups of people and they're trying to get reason with. The notion here is that
it's a volatile cultural construction, if you will.
Groups, including small-scale groups, within your within group politics as well as between group politics, within your group, you know, for hunter-gatherers, for everybody, there's always decisions which can divide people along new lines. And so the notion is your brain is sitting there, and it's always sifting for, is the Fisher point new? And if so, who's going to show up? In order for me to know what I can do in this group, I have to know how people are going to respond. Okay. And therefore, my mind has to somewhat predict response. So if I, you know, I'm in a fight with this person over here, well, most people in the social group line up against me, in which case that would be a bad thing to do. Or most people line up in my favor. Okay. So the mind, the question is, the notion is that there's a, you know, some set of subsystems which are political predictors, alliance predictors.
Yeah.
And it's not just, you know, do I put a tattoo on my face so that, you know, 400 people 20 miles away know about me. It's, you know, what's, you know, when we're arguing at the dinner table, are we going to Disneyland or not, you know, which way are the kids going to go, okay? And that it's this volatility of alliance is something that then creates, so then you can make very special predictions about, when we say this general thing, well, it's cultural, well, you know, in the general sense that it's social and produced volatilely by interaction, yes, it's cultural.
Yes, it is.
But the notion is that there are many kinds of things that could come out of a certain kind of interaction, and we can predict which ones will emerge and which ones will not emerge, okay? And that's a product of specialization.
So somebody has done experiments that compare,
yeah, that would be interesting to do. I mean, we there's a whole set of experiments that we want to do as follow-ups to this. We'd like to do it in places where race is more entrenched, like Virginia. We'd like to do it in Mexico. We have collaborators in these places too. In Mexico, where the black-white dimension is not a very big dimension, but there are other social dimensions that are very important in Mexico. We're about to run an experiment as we speak to see whether do the coalitions have to be antagonistic coalitions, or can they be cooperative coalitions so that each coalition is cooperating to achieve a common goal, but those goals aren't antagonistic to one another. And so we've got two charity groups that are talking to each other on a bus, and, you know, Habitat for Humanity and another one that does nutrition stuff. And so we want to see, I'm hoping they do, but I'm hoping it has the same effect. We actually don't know what will happen there. So there's a huge number. It would be very interesting to mix the kind of cultural cues of dress and put that against the facial cues. This would be a very nice thing. There's a very interesting set of experiments actually about this cross-race recognition deficit. This is like where you think about another race, oh, they all look alike, this thing. It turns out a guy named Dan Levin did beautiful experiments on this, showing that, it's a former student, Frank Kyle's actually, at Yale. He showed that, well, not all everybody has this effect. It's not true of everybody. And what he showed is that the people who have difficulty individuating people of a different race, it's because they're focusing on perceptual features that differentiate, say, whites and blacks, and they're magnifying the salience of those features. And so what that does is that gives them a that gives them an advantage in a different kind of task, which is where you have to categorize people by race. So he has these computer-generated photos that that go from, he took like 10 black faces and averaged them, and then 10 white faces and averaged them, and then he did blends so that you can make a face that's, you know, 90% black, 10% white, et cetera, over to 90%. And you just say, categorize these as black or white. So the people who cannot individuate people are much faster at categorizing the two people into the two groups. They're faster than the people who don't show that deficit.
And
so
it's back around to the
hallucination part.
Okay, the idea is that you could, if the only goal of the human organism was just to sort of recognize people and maximally individuate them in a correct and fast way, then that would emphasize certain perceptual traits which in fact allow correct sorting of individuals as individuals, okay? But if you have this competing task in the same perceptual system, which is in fact, gee, it's really important not just to know that this is a particular individual, but which alliance he or she belongs to, okay? Then that sets a competing task demand, okay, that privileges some perceptual features and that changes what we in fact see. Okay.
My guess is if somebody were wearing a little tiny swastika on them, you'd really notice that. you'd have difficulty taking your eyes off of that, you know?
But even about sometimes, it just means that this process of political tuning or social tuning, okay, changes. So that it was being suggested over here that it's not the case that people can't, that there isn't a set of perceptual dimensions which wouldn't sort people into racial groups. People do sort people into racial groups. People are physical systems. There is an objective set of cues that's doing that. It's just that some objective cues are being picked out of a much larger array, and they're being weighted in a certain way to give this result. Okay, and so that's that.
And other sortings are possible and exist in the world.
Genetics is the underlying genetics. It's the full array of possible dimensions out of which things could be sorted, which brings us back to the fact that we collapse it down to a much smaller set of categories. Yeah.
So is the claim here that society, that our culture has influenced people to see coalitions breaking down along racial lines, or that in the absence of other cues for what the coalition might be, people choose physical features?
The first one. I mean, you know, I mean, we come from a history where there's slavery and people being brought, and there's patterns of cooperation. And oh, that in the absence of anything?
Of other cues for coalition, people will go to the most
obvious. A thing that would be interesting to test that would be to create races that don't exist on Earth. And, like, you know, take people who have pale green and pale blue skin. And run the same sort of experiment and see to what extent that's encoded, where there's no history whatsoever of that having any effect. I don't know what would happen in that experiment, but it could address what you're saying.
Sort of strongly is, what do children see?
The children's literature on children is very, very interesting. Children, it seems to follow the label. So first what children learn are racial labels. And if you ask preschoolers to sort which individuals are black or white or Asian, et cetera, they're very inaccurate if you use as your standard what adults think. So somebody that an adult thinks, oh, that's clearly somebody who's black, the little children will often say the person is white. They acquire the label first. In other words, it doesn't seem to go bottom up from the perceptual world to the category. It's more that the label's there, and then they're trying to figure out which people in the world belong to that category. Larry Hirschfeld, there's a book by Larry Hirschfeld that has a lot of tests about this called Race in the Making. That's very, very interesting thing. We tried an experiment with our daughter of not using any racial terms in her presence, and it was very interesting because, as far as we could tell, she didn't have any racial category. She used to love
Martin Luther King Day.
She came home. She came and said, "Now we had been keeping the dimension of the world from her, but she came home and announced, I know now what black people are." You know, and I'm like, I said, "Well, what?" And she said, "There are people with darker skin." And I saw a picture she drew. And the picture is like of a person with a brown face, orange legs, and blonde hair. But the thing that was interesting is, like, she loved the Cosby Show. She really liked Rudy, you know, the little girl, because she was about the same age. And I heard her talking to her friend, do you watch Cosby? It's really great. And the little friend said, no, what is it? And she said, oh, it's a show about this little girl named Rudy who's, you know, our age, and she's going on talking to it. No mention of any color, anything, nothing. You know, it just wasn't a dimension of the world. But that's what the research on the children looks like. It's very interesting.
It's a suggestion that children also, you know, they're looking at sports teams. They don't recognize that people on the sports team are of different races.
They don't.
And they get confused if adults start to talk about that. They don't know what the adults are talking about exactly.
Yeah.
But are kids able to recognize different sex?
Different sex? Yeah. Can I say a more precise way of putting the question is, which mechanism of the mind does it at what age? So at birth, there are mechanisms that are tuned to respond differentially to female voices versus male voices. That doesn't mean that other mechanisms of the mind have a category male and female. That, you know, you have to break it down. If you have a lot of computational mechanisms in your head, there can be a distinction made by one of them that's not made by some of the other ones. But at least some of the mechanisms are making a distinction based on cues that are correlated with male and female from birth. And then later it gets more complicated and more cognitive and so on. See, that's what I'm saying. It's hard to say what it means an instinct because, you know, there are, like I said, there are some mechanisms that at birth are distinguishing male and female voices. That doesn't mean the child has a higher level concept of male or female. I'm not sure at exactly what age they have that. I'm pretty sure they have it by 3, and I think they have it before. They gender segregate at 18 months.
Before the adults.
On the playground.
Before the adults can reliably sort them by sex.
You know, they're all wearing little overalls on the playground with little bowl haircuts on the playground, and they're gender segregating, and adults are trying to get them to not gender segregate, and they're doing it. And,
yeah. Tony's looking
worried.
There's
a question open here.
A number of years ago, I visited the Balayan Valley near Anjaya. I don't know if you know about that. It's a place that was in the Stone Age, basically, until 1938.
Mm-hmm.
And it was completely isolated from the outside world. There are 3 different tribes in the Balayan Valley. It's quite clear that they've been able to interact extensively throughout their whole history.
Yeah.
So the idea that somehow different hunter-gatherer tribes were not coming into contact with other people of different races, in this case certainly is not.
Well, what makes you call the people of different races? It's different tribes?
The physical characteristics of these people were so different that the first day I was there, I could tell which one was of which race, and I had never even heard of these different tribes before I came. It was also clear once we got to know the place a little bit that they made the same kinds of racial distinctions that we do. They were, you know, fighting with each other, and the Yalis were not talking to the Lamis, and, you know, there were all kinds of things going on at that time. And it seemed to me, thinking about it then, that there was a much more complicated thing which both supports your hypothesis but puts a slightly different light on it. It seemed to me fairly evident that it wasn't that there were 3 separate gene pools that were thrown into this valley, but that, you know, people started living together for coalitional reasons, and then they developed different physical characteristics because they had a limited set of genes to play with among their coalition. So race, in that case, it seemed to me, was created by social mechanism. But it was quite striking. These people were all black. From the skin color point of view, it was very hard to tell the difference between the tone of their skin. But their facial features and their statures were just so different that it was, as I say, you know, you came in the first day and bang, you knew this guy was this guy was that, this guy was the other. And then you had to learn the name for what this, that, and the other meant.
That suggests that there wasn't much intermarriage between these two groups.
There certainly was not. Okay, but they lived in very close proximity, presumably for all.
You have things like that in parts of Africa where, you know, Maasai people are very tall and thin, Kikuyu people less so, Somali people are claimed to look a little different. It's a little bit hard without, it sometimes can be hard without anthropometric measures and also taking people's garb away. because these things form these gestalts for us that are kind of interesting. So there were.
I
don't actually know about this particular case, but there are cases, like for example, where of Somalis that were chased into Ethiopia, I can't remember, and literally without anything, you know, without clothes, without anything. And these are, they're believed to be, look different, but the local culture, people say, oh, that's obviously a Somali, that's obviously a Somali. But when these refugees were being chased in, one of the sort of social problems was that the local people could no longer tell them from the other local people. And so sometimes there's this effect of when somebody has a certain accent and they have a certain way of dress and so forth, they can actually magnify these differences. I'm not saying that the differences you're talking about don't exist. But it would be an interesting question to actually do it anthropometrically.
Also, it's not the claim that never in our evolutionary history did people who were substantially morphologically different ever encounter each other. The claim is that was not so regular a phenomenon as to drive throughout our species the fixation of genes for
a computational mechanism that goes
right. The population of this valley were genetically isolated from the rest of the world apparently.
Yes.
Throughout most of their history up until 1938?
For, I would say, yeah, maybe for a few thousand years at most, I would actually say probably. These things get, the ethnographic present tends to be projected as a state of nature in the past for much longer periods than when people go and do the genetics, they find that there's been much more mixing than people have.
But you can also get, you know, odd, you can also get, oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, so if there are no further questions, this is running late.
Okay.